We're looking at the final intervention of a good friend. And here we're talking about Jonathan and David, that relationship once again. Let's begin reading in verse 1 of chapter 20, again verses 1 through 11. Then David fled from Naoth and Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity? And what is my sin before your father that he's seeking my life?" He said to him, "Far from it. You shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so." Yet David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight." And he said, "Do not let Jonathan know this, or he will be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death." Then Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do it for you." So David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I ought to sit down to eat with the king, but let me go that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, because it's the yearly sacrifice there for the whole family.' If he says, 'It is good, your servant will be safe.' But if he is very angry, know that he has decided on evil. Therefore, deal kindly with your servant. For you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is iniquity in me, put me to death yourself, for why then should you bring me to your father?" Jonathan said, "Far be it from you. For if I should indeed learn that evil has been decided by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you about it?" Then David said to Jonathan, "Who will tell me if your father answers you harshly?" Jonathan said to David, "Come, and let us go out into the field." So both of them went out into the field. Verses 18 through 20 of the last chapter, we mentioned this last week, back up in the text a bit. And they refer to verse 12 of the last chapter where David had escaped after Michael's warning. And we see that David left Michael. After David left Michael, he fled to Samuel, who was in Ramah. Verse 18, we're looking again, chapter 19 for a moment, just by way of review. It says, "Now David fled and escaped and came to Samuel at Ramah." So Samuel lived less than an hour's walk from Saul's headquarters. And then it says, "And he and Samuel went and stayed in Naoth." Naoth, and we mentioned this last time, it means habitations, and may very well not be a proper noun, but it may very well be just a descriptive noun of where they were, because it means habitations. In other words, these were probably the compound of dwellings in the city of Ramah where Samuel's group of prophets lived. So they're still in the same city, but they went to this compound within Ramah. And then we see in verse 19 that somebody ratted David out. Told Saul, "Here he is. He's in Naoth." Notice verses 20 and 21, "The Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied." And by the way, this happened to two other sets of Saul's messengers. And then, verse 22, "Then he himself went to Ramah." Now, the amazing thing is how rebellious and spiritually insensitive that Saul is. He knows that he's going against God. I mean, this is not just some mere accident. Three sets of messengers have already been directly dealt with by God, and now he supposes that he's going to be the one to have victory here. He's going to be the one who's going to be able to resist God. Really? What a fool. And we see here, indeed, Saul is being the fool. He's playing the fool. Notice verse 23 of the last chapter, verse 23. "So Saul's servant spoke these words to David, but David said, 'Is it trivial in your sight to become the,'" chapter 19, chapter 19, I didn't mean 18, chapter 19 and verse 23, if I can turn the page. As for the agreement of which you and I have spoken, behold, the Lord is between me and you forever. Verse 24, so David hid in the field, and when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. Let's see. Am I in the wrong chapter again, I think? Yes, I am. I'm in chapter 20. Man, I'm not feeling well, folks. I apologize. Just not feeling great with this allergy outbreak. Let's go ahead and look at verse 24 in chapter 19, shall we? It's the last verse. He also stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Therefore, they say, is Saul also among the prophets? Now, keep in mind that in the Jewish mind, nakedness did not mean complete nudity. He had removed his outer garments. He was no doubt still wearing that tunic. It was an undergarment under the, really under his royal robes. Remember, he's the king of Israel. So he strips off his royal robes. And honestly, this is no doubt symbolic of God's disapproval on and rejection of his kingship. It's over for him. He'd lost all dignity. Regally and personally, he's lost all dignity. Now he's sitting there in his undergarment, in his tunic. Again, not totally naked, but in the Jewish mind, when you said naked, this is what you were talking about. Therefore, they say, is Saul also among the prophets? Here's a negative statement. Now, why do I say that? We mentioned this last time. Because to question the genuineness of Saul's prophetic behavior was to question his legitimacy as king. We read this to you last week. Ronald Youngblood, he writes this. The use of this proverb first in chapter 10, verses 11 and 12, and now here, brackets the narrative descriptions of Saul's first and last encounters with Samuel, as well as with the Spirit of God. Neither legitimate king nor genuine prophet, Saul continues to stumble toward his doom at the hands of the Philistines when he will be stripped of his garments for the last time. So he eventually will be completely stripped of his garments. It's more than just symbolic. It's going to be over. His life is going to be over before much longer. And then as we move now into chapter 20, got the right chapter this time, we move into chapter 20, we see David's loyal, covenanted friend, Jonathan, making one final attempt to intervene with his father on David's behalf. And so we see in verses 1 through 3, first of all, a desperate situation related. Notice, first of all, in verse 1, then David fled from Naoth and Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, what have I done? What is my iniquity? And what is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life? In order for David to avoid Saul's attacks on him, he would have to abandon his friend Jonathan and his wife Michal. And no doubt, David is hoping he's somehow at fault. Although he's fearing he's not, but he's hoping he's some way at fault so that he might repent, he might make the relationship with Saul right again. I think something that's striking here is just David's humility. David is not walking around thinking, I'm right, I'm always right, and Saul's an idiot, I'm not going to respect him. He always had a healthy respect for Saul. Why? He was a king of Israel. He was God's anointed. Now, obviously, God had taken his hand of blessing off of him by this time. But there was still a real respect here by David for Saul. It's interesting as David approaches this situation and he says, is it me? Am I at fault? Kill me now. Don't wait for your father if I've done some kind of sin. What sin have I done against your dad? It's interesting. Walking with God can sometimes be difficult and confusing. there was some confusion here, perhaps in David's mind. You know, why is he trying to kill me? Why is this happening? But yeah, walking with God can be difficult. David found that out. It can sometimes be confusing. You ever been confused about God's will for your life? I've been. I remember many years ago, there was a church that my wife and I and my daughter at the time, she was a teenager at the time. there was a church that had called, and we really felt that God was leading us in that direction. This actually happened a couple of times, too, in the past. But we thought God was leading us in that direction, and so it came down to the vote, and we didn't get voted in. It was kind of confusing because it was, Lord, I thought you were leading us here. You seem to be opening up all the doors, but then the doors shut, closed hard. We were absolutely sure, you know, it was God's will. But, you know, sometimes walking with God can be confusing. Maybe you found that in your own life. You thought you knew what, you know, God, how God was working in your life, and he ends up shutting the doors. Look, don't try to kick the door open. If God shuts a door, don't try to kick it open. If God opens a door, walk through it. But don't try to fight against God and what he has for you. But yeah, walking with God, it can be difficult. In fact, it always is, really. And it can be confusing. Keep in mind, too, that when we walk with God faithfully, that some people are going to hate us. True of David, right? Some people are going to hate us. They're going to oppose us simply because we want to follow the Lord and we want to do his will. So you think you're better than I am? No. I just want to do what's right. I just want to follow the Lord Jesus Christ. Their hatred and opposition is not the result of our sinfulness, but the result of theirs. And that was true, you see, of David. David didn't do anything wrong. That's pretty plain. Jonathan obviously saw nothing that David did that was wrong. And the problem with Saul was not the result of David's sinfulness. It was a result of Saul's sinfulness. And so we'll find that to be true in our own lives at times. And then it says, David fled from Naoth in Ramah. So while the Spirit of God detained Saul, David went to visit his best friend. And it says, notice he says, what is my iniquity? What's a sin before your father that he's seeking my life? And here David asks his best friend for an appraisal of his life and actions. Have I done anything wrong? You know, it's not bad if we have a close friend. It's not bad that we have a close friend who can be honest about our lives. And we can be honest about theirs. Accountability is good in the Christian life. I've heard people say things like, well, but accountability, isn't that like a crutch? You know, we have a broken leg, sometimes we do need a crutch. But no, it's not a crutch. It's called fellowship. It's what we do as believers. We help one another. We encourage one another. So the fact that, you know, we have a friend of ours and we ask for an appraisal of our lives, how do you think I'm doing? Do you think I'm living for the Lord properly? Are there any attitudes or problems you see in my life? It's not bad to have an accountability partner like that, and even accountable for one another. Why? Well, we get blind spots sometimes, don't we? I was at the Wilds some years ago, and Wilds Christian Camp in Rosman, North Carolina, and they had a session there for leaders, and it was on blind spots. And the whole session was talking about our Christian lives, and sometimes we get blind spots. In other words, we don't see that we're struggling with some area of our lives, but it's quite obvious to a lot of other people. And so one of the things that he suggested was having an accountability partner, just what we're talking about here. And I think that's important. Someone you can sit down with and say, evaluate my life. What do you think? Even if that's done between husband and wife, that's a good thing too. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a person outside the home, but it might be your wife, it might be your husband, and that's fine too. But have I done anything wrong? You know, are there blind spots here, Jonathan? We need to be transparent. You know, all of us value secrecy because of our human pride, but we need to be transparent. David was transparent with his friend. Do you see anything? I mean, what have I done? What have I done that was sinful? Notice verse 2 of chapter 20, verse 2. He said to him, "Far from it, you shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing either great or small without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so." Can't be so. My dad doesn't hide things from me. You know, it's been said denial ain't just a river in Egypt, okay? This is denial here, no question about it. Jonathan is in a state of denial. You know, it's easy to do this with people that we love. Jonathan loves his dad. I mean, he should. There's nothing wrong with that. But he's developed a blind spot even about his own dad. He's in denial. More than that, it seems as though Jonathan is completely unaware of his father's latest attempt to snuff out the life of David in chapter 19, verses 8 through 24. He's apparently relying on the strong oath that his father took in chapter 19 and verse 7 that he would not harm David. Too bad he can't depend on his dad's word of honor, isn't it? Daddy promised, it's got to be true. Folks, how are you as a parent? Can your kids depend on you? When you make a promise, do you go through with it? I've heard parents time and time again make promises to their kids that they know they can't fulfill. Folks, that's just a lie. That's all that is. We shouldn't lie to one another. Most of all, to our kids. What are we teaching our kids when we say, "I promise if you do this, I'll do this," just so that your kids do that? And then you don't come through with your promise. Hey, can your kids, can your grandkids depend on you and on your word? Is your word as good as gold, or? Yeah, we'll see. It's too bad when kids have to say about their parents or grandparents, "Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Maybe grandma, grandpa, maybe mom and dad will come through, maybe they won't." Now, I understand that there are times when things don't work out. You make a promise, things don't work out. There's always emergencies that occur. But by and large, we ought to be true to our promises that we make to our family, to our kids, to our husbands, to our wives. We ought to come through with those promises. And then notice verse 3. Yet David vowed again, saying, "Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight. And he has said, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, or he will be grieved.' But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death." Again, notice, apparently, David's vow was a lot more reliable than Jonathan's. David vowed again. Isn't that too bad? He could depend on David more than he could his own father. But truth be told, that's absolutely true. Notice verse 4. There we see a heartfelt promise given in verse 4. "Then Jonathan said to David, 'Whatever you say, I'll do for you.'" So Jonathan also had much to lose if these accusations against his father were true. He would lose both the companionship of his best friend, and he'd be alienated from his daddy, from his father. So he had a lot to lose as well, but he says to David, "Whatever you say, I'll do for you." Although Jonathan, yes, is in a state of disbelief, he still trusts his friend. He trusts his friend enough that he's willing to do anything that David wanted to do to prove his point. And so again, he knew David was a man of his word, and he was going to trust David's heartfelt promise here in verse 4. And then we see in verses 5 through 11 a defining test proposed. Verses 5 through 11, defining test proposed. Notice verse 5. So David said to Jonathan, "Behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I ought to sit down to eat with the king, but let me go that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening." Numbers chapter 10, Numbers chapter 28, verses 11 through 15. And the new moon introduced a new month, which the Israelites celebrated with a sacrificial meal. So this is not some pagan festival here, okay? It was both a religious ceremony and it was a civil ceremony. As a high-ranking military commander and a man who was part of Saul's court, David would normally sit at the table with Saul. So, in other words, he'd be noticed if he weren't there. "But let me go that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening." Thomas Constable wrote, "Hiding in a field seems to be an extreme measure. Why could David not have gone home to Bethlehem or stayed with friends who would have kept his presence secret from Saul? Perhaps David trusted no one but Jonathan now." Remember, David had given a command to all of his staff, to his whole administration, that he wanted this man dead. So who could David trust? Well, he knew he could trust Jonathan. And probably at this point, he's the only one. So he's going to trust Jonathan no one else. The 3 days that he's talking about here were enough time for Saul to notice David isn't here. Now, I'm sure it didn't take a whole bunch of time for Saul to notice, okay? He was vengeful. He wanted him dead. I'm sure it didn't take him a long time, but he assumes some things here, which we'll see. But anyhow, verse 6. "If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asks leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, because it is the yearly sacrifice for the whole family." So if your father misses me at all, no doubt he would. He was out to kill him. But Jonathan was to be a passive observer until Saul asked him. And then it says, David earnestly asked leave of me. This is the lie that was to take place here in verse 6. If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, because it's a yearly sacrifice there for his whole family. So notice that David's plan involved telling a lie to Saul, that David was at his annual family reunion in Bethlehem that coincided with this festival. So this is why David's not here. Now, the Bible presents people as real people with all of their blemishes, with all of their sins. We see that in the life of David, not just here, but we see it other times. This is not justifying David's lie. This is not the right thing to do. Shame on David for asking his friend to lie for him. Shame on Jonathan for doing it. It shows a lack of faith, and lying always shows a lack of faith. You know, we can't trust God with the results, so we have to create our own reality. We can't trust God with the results, so, you know, we have to change things. We have to help God out a little bit because he's not powerful enough to take care of it. Early on, David relied on a combination of trickery and trust to get along, both of them together. Later, though, David, through trial, was perfected. Remember what James 1 says. And he learned to trust God more completely. So, yeah, we see human beings as real people in the Bible. And we also see David, who got better at it. We see David, who trusted early on the Lord, but yet trickery was part of it too. Lies were a part of it. But soon he would learn his lesson, and he would begin to trust God more fully. Verse 7. If he says, "It is good, your servant will be safe." But if he is very angry, know that he has decided on evil. Now, obviously, if Saul was intent on killing David as soon as possible, his absence from the festival is going to upset him, no doubt. If he were concerned about David, he would be glad that he was with his family. So this plan would show how Saul genuinely believed about this whole thing, if he really was going to kill David or not. And it would also show Jonathan that David was legitimate in his concern. Verse 8, "Therefore deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. But if there is iniquity in me, put me to death yourself, for why then should you bring me to your father?" Notice in verse 8, he says, deal kindly. The Hebrew word here is the Hebrew word chesed. It refers to loving covenant loyalty. It's used of God's loving covenant loyalty to Israel. But here, we're talking about loving covenant loyalty between friends. The covenant that they had made with each other is in chapter 18, verses 3 and 4. We already saw that. So David appealed to their covenant of friendship and asked that if he had done anything sinful that had caused Saul to become angry at him, to want to kill him, that Jonathan at this point was to kill David and not bother taking him to Saul at all. In other words, if it's my fault, deal with me now. Don't take me to your father. Notice that David had temporarily lost sight of God's promise to him. And I mean, we say, okay, it's, you know, this is part of David's tactic. I understand that. But he had temporarily lost sight of God's promise to him. He was going to be king. He was anointed king. And so he wasn't going to die. Jonathan was not going to kill him. So he had lost sight of some of that. Folks, we all do that. Again, this book presents David as a real person, all his foibles, all his sins, all of his stutters in his living his life for the Lord. And yeah, another sight of his lack of trust. Again, that would change. David would grow in this area of his life, but right now he's immature. Verse 9, Jonathan said, "Far be it from you, for I should indeed learn that evil has been decided by my father to come upon you. Then would I not tell you about it? Far be it from you." Jonathan flat out refuses to do this. He's not going to kill him. He's not going to kill his best friend. "For if I should indeed learn that evil has been decided by my father to come upon you, then why would I not tell you about it?" So secondly, he communicates to David in the form of a question that he so strongly valued David's life, that if he had any inkling that his father was going to harm him, that his father was going to kill him, he was going to tell him. Again, I find this friendship between them impressive. Strong friendship. Notice that they're based on trust. Strong friendships always were and always are. And friendships and relationships in marriage should be based on trust as well. Husbands and wives ought to be able to trust one another, trust the promises made to each other. And so a strong friendship between husband and wife is also based on trust as well. Notice verse 10. "Then David said to Jonathan, 'Who will tell me if your father's answers you harshly?'" Good question. How's this going to work? You go to your daddy and you find out he's angry at me. How am I going to find this out? Verse 11. Jonathan said to David, come and let us go out into the field. So both of them went out into the field. Now, Jonathan then suggests a plan by which he could let David know what was happening without revealing David's location. And we're going to see that next time in our second part of this message, which is the final intervention of a good friend, part two. And we'll see it verse 12 and following from here. As we close the service, what kind of a friend are you? What kind of relationships do you have? Can your children trust you? Can your spouse trust you? Can other people in this church trust you? Is your word your bond? Is your word worth anything to people, or do you just say things to smooth things over without really being serious? In other words, do you lie? We shouldn't, folks. Our word ought to be our bond. People ought to be able to trust in us regardless. And I hope as we close this service, as we consider as believers, are we truthful? Do we have the right kind of relationship with those around us? And then number two, if you're here today and you've never trusted the Lord Jesus Christ as Savior from sin, this could be the greatest day of your life if you just trust Him now to save you from sin. Have you ever done that before? And if you haven't, we'd like to be able to take a Bible, show you how you can be 100% sure that if you died today, that you'd go to heaven.